Hello, cricket world, and welcome to episode one of Andy Zaltzman's World Cricket Podcast.
Andy Zaltzman's World Cricket Podcast.
I am comedian Andy Zaltzman, author of the Confectionery Store blog on Crick Info, and 98% of my brain is cricket. Is that a waste? Yes, of the other 2%. Although, as the great West Indian C.L.R. James wrote, what do they know of cricket who only cricket know? Well, to answer you, C.L.R., statistics mainly, and fielding drills. In this week's inaugural World Cricket Podcast, perhaps the most significant development in the history of broadcasting since a caveman first discovered that more cave women could hear him shout and see him wave his club around if he was standing on top of a woolly mammoth, I will be looking at the cavalcade of international cricket that has been shoving itself into our faces recently. I'll be bringing you the cricket news that others fear to relate and slapping a big fat statistic down on the table and telling you to eat it for your breakfast. So where else to start than with the South Africa versus England one-day series? Well, plenty of places. Test matches, to begin with. And in a year that's seen more than its fair share of unfathomably tedious high-scoring draws, Dunedin played host to a classic. Now, of course, the words classic test match and New Zealand don't always dance merrily hand in hand, but this was what cricket scientists would call proper cricket. The home team narrowly defeated Pakistan. Hang on, did I read that right? Pakistan playing a test match? Take that, Al-Qaeda! Take that! And it was the complete test match, five fluctuating days in which batsmen and bowlers each had their periods of dominance, culminating in an exciting finish, all viewed by about 26 people and a couple of escaped crested grebes from the Dunedin Bird Sanctuary. To be honest, I didn't actually see a single ball of it, but I still loved every ball of it. Just watching the numbers on the internet move in both runs and wickets columns was enough for me, because at the start of this year I watched almost every ball of the batsman-dominated West Indies v England series, and by the end of it, I wanted to hibernate. So this was a great match. Umar Akmal played one of the finest debuts of the millennium so far, and, glory of glories, both Shane Bond and Mohammad Asif actually played. Statistically, of all the bowlers who've made their test debuts this decade and taken 20 test wickets, Bond and Asif are the best. Both average 22. Between them, however, they've played just 30 tests out of the 101 their countries have played since their debuts. They have failed to play in nearly as many tests as I have, which is going some. A performance record so paltry as to be easily mistakable for a coop full of chickens. And that is the first paltry pun of this podcast, and I humbly pledge the last for now. Reassuringly, for those who like their universe to be in order, Bond is now injured again, and it can only be a matter of time before Asif finds another ludicrous way to get banned, perhaps trying to fire an umpire to the moon out of a massive catapult, or testing positive for illegal levels of unpasteurised French cheese, or failing to turn up for a training camp after being cornered in his garden shed by a giant imaginary moth. Who knows? Meanwhile, in India, Mahendra Dhoni's men steamrolled Sri Lanka in the second test after a characteristic barrage of Sehwagic magnificence on the first day. There are not many 100% verifiable facts in the world these days, and that certainly isn't one of them, but I would confidently suggest that one fact is that Virender Sehwag is a more exciting batsman than Alastair Cook. And I think, in their heart of hearts, even Alastair Cook and Alastair Cook's mummy would acknowledge that. Now, I can't imagine what it's like as a bowler going to work on a nice sunny morning, only to find Virender Sehwag and a good batting pitch waiting in your in-tray. Must be pretty dispiriting. I imagine the feeling of having to bowl to Sehwag on a flat pitch is akin to being an office secretary asked to do some photocopying, only to find that the photocopier has been replaced with a man-eating lion. In fact, Sehwag often bats as if he has just eaten that man-eating lion, raw. Impressive work for a committed vegetarian, but that's just the kind of cricketer Sehwag is. He defies the rules. I've spent a lot of time recently wondering what people would make of Sehwag if he were to be transported back in time and plonked into the 1950s, when a run rate of 2 per over was considered irresponsibly cavalier. I imagine they would watch him bat and say, I've no idea what sport he thinks he's playing, but it sure as hell isn't cricket. Anyway, an imposing win for India, and as I speak, the third test is underway. And if you're a fan of history, which I am, I mean, I love it. I've got posters of history all over my bedroom wall, and I got its autograph at a book signing once. I digress. You would expect India not to lose from 1-0 up. I would certainly expect that. But then again, I was first entranced by cricket during the 1981 Ashes series, and the following winter, England went to India, lost the first test, and then played out five consecutive draws of skull-crushing tedium, until the schedule brought a merciful end to it. And you do get the feeling that otherwise, Keith Fletcher and his men would still be there, 28 years later, and still be 1-0 down, after 837 consecutive drawn tests. But my love for cricket survived that series, and I knew then it would never die. Although, to be fair, I hadn't factored Alan Stanford into my calculations. I wonder what he's up to these days. We haven't really heard from him in a while. I guess he must be tied up with something. Oh, yep, I remember now. Spot a bother with the US legal system. I guess it is ironic in a way that a man who claimed to love 2020 so much is now having to rely very heavily on his defence.
It's cricket time!
In Australia, Ricky Ponting led his nation to an innings win over the West Indies, so they've probably forgotten that the Ashes ever even happened. In an opinion poll of 100,000 randomly selected people from around the planet taken before the first Australia-West Indies test, 99,856 people predicted that Australia would win easily, including some 75,000 people who'd never even heard of cricket. The remaining 144 people forecast that West Indies would blow Australia away with their barrage of devastatingly hostile fast bowling, before the Caribbean batsmen flayed the Aussie bowlers flamboyantly to all parts of the Southern Hemisphere. But 143 of these 144 people had just emerged from 20-year comas, and the other one was relying on a dubious interpretation of the Book of Revelations. The main matter of interest in the game was a sparkling second innings debut 100 by Adrian Barath. His devastating offside play was reminiscent of, well, who shall we say, maybe a young Andy Zaltzman. Well, I once hit a really good square cut for my school third 11. Does that count? Anyway, it was a fine innings, and this leads to the first in a regular World Cricket Podcast feature.
Splat! It's a Zaltstat!
Barath and Umar Akmal have joined some illustrious names in reaching three figures in their first test, unquestionable greats of the game, from W.G. Grace and Ranjit Singh, George Headley and Greg Chappell, to Dirk Wellham and Ali Naqvi, all live contenders for the all-time World 11 in my book, albeit that my book has chapters written by Dirk Wellham's mummy and Ali Naqvi's best friend from school. And that, listeners, is a world comedy first. Dirk Wellham and Ali Naqvi appearing in the same joke. They said it would never happen. They said it could never happen. But have Barath and Umar actually unwittingly condemned themselves to a career of total failure? Because of the 81 men who'd scored debut test hundreds before this year, 30 then failed to score another 100. That's no more hundreds in 230 combined tests, for varying reasons. Some, like Rodney Redmond or Andy Gontome, never played again. Some, like Archie Jackson, took the disappointing career option of dropping dead. And some, like Dirk Wellham, were Dirk Wellham. A further 13 debut centurions have gone on to score only one more century. So a sample of more than half of debut centurions has gone on to score a frankly piddling 13 further hundreds in 434 subsequent test matches. That is one every 33 games. That is worse than England all-rounder Chris Lewis's one in 32 tests. And look what happened to him. Currently 100% more in jail than most cricketers like to be. Certainly not playing with a lot of freedom these days, shall we say. About an hour a day in the exercise yard, a few hours kip, and then about 15 hours a day thinking about when he bowled Tendulkar out in the Lord's Test in 1996. Absolute beauty. I guess he's probably hoping that a relative can smuggle a copy of that year's Wisden just to prove that it was really him.
How's that?
So to South Africa against England. England have continued their recent trend of veering wildly between excellence and ineptitude, taking Rudyard Kipling's advice from his hit poem If, and treating the twin imposters of triumph and disaster the same, by taking spurious positives from them, then refusing to repeat them in the next match. One game, England are perfectly focused, executing their game plan as smoothly as Henry VIII used to execute his wives. But the next, they're thrashed like a naughty Victorian schoolboy. And if this pattern continues, and let's not forget it was the pattern that confused Australia so much that England won the Ashes, South Africa will win the final match of the one-day series by at least 10 wickets, or 350 runs. Take your pick. For their part, South Africa have been equally up and down, although they are clearly still producing some excellent cricketers, who then go on to play for England. I'm sure we must have a few spare county cricketers knocking around that we don't really need, that we can just give South Africa as a thank you present. Other cricket news now, and following a spate of injuries, England have announced that they will no longer warm up for their matches by playing football. Instead, coach Andy Flower says the team will fight each other in brutal 15-round bare-knuckle boxing bouts. Flower said, "We want to build team camaraderie, and smashing each other in the face like it's still the 19th century is the best way to do that. Sure, the players might have to take the field with the odd broken nose or swollen head here and there, but as long as they avoid the twisted ankles and knee ligament damage that are the real problems these days, that is a price worth paying." So that's it for the first ever Andy Zaltzman's World Cricket Podcast. If it turns out to be anything like Test cricket in exactly 100 years' time, there'll be a podcast commemorating this podcast that will end up being exactly as funny as this one. That's a joke for all you 1976-77 Melbourne Centenary Test fans out there. That game ended in a 45-run win for Australia against England. Amazingly, the exact same result and margin of victory as happened in the first ever Test 100 years earlier. I've over-explained the joke now. The magic's gone. First rule of comedy, don't over-explain the joke. Second rule of comedy, never make jokes about the winning margins of two long-distance test matches. That's why Eddie Murphy made it so big. He never fell into that trap. I'll be back soon with another podcast, and hopefully, if I can work out how to use my computer properly, a guest as well, and some funkier music. Anyway, I'll play you out with some lies about cricketers. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. If Don Bradman had been a woman, he'd have scored twice as many runs, four times as quickly. When Zahir Abbas was born, he was the same size and shape as a cricket bat. If Ian Botham had been Neil Armstrong, the first words he would have said when he landed on the moon would have been, "How's that? Come on, that has to be out." When Ravi Shastri was a little boy, he couldn't tell the difference between a cricket ball and a tomato. Former New Zealand opener Bruce Edgar is afraid of curtains. And ex-England captain Ray Illingworth owns 2,500 sofas.